think today, of all days, we all are really rather keen on cricket. Hello and welcome to the Inside Edge with the Cricketer magazine here on Love Sport Radio. You're with me, Johnny Burrow, and James Coyne, assistant editor of the Cricketer magazine, looking back on a sensational day for England. James, were you expecting it to be that comprehensive?
Not quite. I was actually fairly confident going into the game, given that obviously England had won those last two group games against two teams at the pointy end of the tournament. They were effectively knockout games themselves, and I think that probably helped England, actually, that they had those two high-octane games against New Zealand and India that got them into this point. And I think that sort of got rid of some of the jangle of nerves, because they'd already had that jangle of nerves. And they cope with it very well today. We know Australia don't like playing at Edgbaston, do they? So I think that was also a factor. But I think the wonder of this World Cup really has been the way the ball's done stuff at the start. And you get great practitioners like Bolt, like Archer, like Wokes, and they've done stuff with that white ball, and it's made this World Cup the spectacle that it is. I think the balance between bat and ball has been recalibrated, and I think that's been, in my opinion, the magic of this World Cup.
What do you think's brought that balance about?
It's hard to say. I mean, I think pitches are always a slightly inexact science. No one really understands them apart from groundsmen, really. But I think I'm fairly sure that the edict that has been put out there at the start is that these have to be the best cricket wickets, as opposed to the flattest pitches on earth, which is what we've had in one day cricket in England for the past 4 or 5 years or so. So there's been a little bit less pace in the pitch. The ball seems to have done a little bit. I mean, we're going to get Tymal Mills on later on, and he'll know more about that. But it does seem to me that the white kookaburra has done a little bit more than it has done in previous years, and it's just meant that batsmen, it only takes a smidgen of difference of movement and going on for a bit longer than it has before, and batsmen have to change the way they play. And that's actually been a real pleasure of the tournament, in my opinion.
And in terms of England's performance today, where did they win it? Was it with the bowlers to get Australia out for a relatively low score, or was it that batting performance today?
Oh, I think it's the bowlers, no doubt about it. I mean, it's the same way that New Zealand won that, in a similar way that New Zealand won that semi-final yesterday. You know, once Wokes and Archer had made those blows at the top, they got Warner out. You know, they got Finch out. It put Australia on the back foot, and it meant they're forced into a rebuilding process. And yes, Roy and Bairstow batted very well once they got through a similarly potentially difficult thing at the start of England's innings, but really it was the bowlers that kept Australia down to a manageable target. And yeah, it's the bowlers, no doubt about it.
And in terms of the batsmen, how hard was the task they had to do in terms of that total they were chasing?
Well, it's hard in the sense that this is a knockout game, and I think, you know, 240 in a bilateral game on that pitch in any other summer would have been a walk in the park, unless something astonishing happened. But in a knockout game, it was a little bit easier than it would have been. And once Roy and Bairstow had put that partnership on, then it became a lot easier for Root and Morgan, who still play very well, but don't get me wrong. But I think the pressure of a knockout game does make it harder in these situations. But yeah, overall, the conditions were pretty good. They had the crowd behind them. Yeah, I mean, but they did it very well, didn't they?
Is there ever a worry of complacency, where particularly when the first openings, you're looking consistent early on in an innings, is there ever a wonder, well, hang on, we're going to knock this off quite easily?
Well, that's an interesting point, in that in this World Cup, you look back at the Sri Lanka game where we were chasing a similar target. In fact, it was almost identical, I think. And I wouldn't say they were complacent, but they didn't quite know what to do, in the sense that, and I spoke to Jonathan Trott about this recently, and obviously I don't want to paraphrase him too much, but he said that they're almost happier chasing 350 than they are chasing 230, because they've got absolute clarity, if you're chasing 350, about what you've got to go and do. You know, these are lads that are playing IPL, they're playing a lot of much more high-scoring one-day cricket than we've had in this tournament. If you're chasing 350, there's no doubt what you've got to go and do, and it's your default setting almost. Chasing 240 is a little bit different, but I think the Sri Lanka experience will have helped them, and they went out there with a bit more certainty about what they were doing. Obviously, they had a better start as well, but I think that's more the issue, is how do you go about chasing a slightly smaller target, which I know it seems completely counterintuitive. You know, you and I would think, well, surely it's easier chasing 240 than 350. But these are blokes with all the shots in the book. So, you know, that's another factor.
Does it almost take the pressure off to know that you've just got to chase something huge and that nothing other than just attacking will do it? Well,
that's what I mean. I think that's basically what I'm saying. You know, it's the absolute clarity in the batsman's mind, and they can go into their T20 mode. But actually, I think that's been the fascinating thing about this World Cup. How have we been talking about one-day cricket in the last 10 years or so? A lot of people have been saying it's T20 on speed. You know, it's long-form T20. Actually, this World Cup has been more like short-form test cricket. Mm. The pace of the game, the feel of the game, the way the ball's moved, it's been more like test cricket than one-day cricket has been more like T20 in the past.
But equally, we have seen criticism of certain batsmen for playing a perceived too test-like game. MS Dhoni, for example, has taken quite a lot of stick from Indian fans for basically not getting on with it. How does a top-class batsman strike that balance?
Yeah, I mean, I think Dhoni would play that way pretty much regardless. I mean, he'll obviously change it a little bit, but regardless of the conditions, that's just the way he plays. He always takes time at the start and grows into it and almost builds to this crescendo of finishing it in the last over. It obviously didn't work yesterday. I think it's more relevant when it comes to the top order batsmen. You know, your likes of Sharma and Kohli and in the England side and other teams have been far more circumspect at the start. And that's, I think, where we've seen the difference, where teams have been content to build big partnerships, but much slower than they would have done. I think that's where we see the real difference there.
I'm just amazed by their ability to remain calm. And I know they're top-class sportsmen. This is nothing new.
Yeah.
But the pressure of a World Cup semi-final, how do you think that Morgan would have prepared them for that?
It's an interesting thing. And I think it's behind the entire rationale behind England's white ball revolution over the last 4 years. You know, Andrew Strauss, and we all know there was a big hoo-ha when Andrew Strauss was the captain about Kevin Peterson going off and playing in the IPL. It was pretty much the crux of that breakdown of communication. But Strauss has came round to the idea, and he realised that England's players need to go off and play in the IPL. They need to play in the Big Bash. They need to play these big high-pressure tournaments where you're the overseas player, you've got pressure heaped on you, playing these elimination games in front of huge crowds. And this is a way of building players up to play in these massive tournaments, because, you know, it's different playing a test match and it's different playing a domestic one-day game or a domestic T20 game. The pressure of today is higher than that. And so I think that's the rationale, that these players are conditioned more to those high-pressure environments. We're only talking a couple of degrees here, and I'm not saying the players before weren't conditioned to that, but it's being able to trust your game and go out and play your natural game in those high-pressure environments. That's the difference. And I think that has been, in a way, vindication of what Strauss and the others agreed. Now, look, I don't think that changes if England go out and lose to New Zealand on Sunday. You know, the fact that they've got to this point and they've played the cricket they have in the last few games vindicates it already, in my opinion.
But isn't it going to be slightly harder for them, in a sense, to go up against New Zealand? Because particularly after a performance, a scoreline like that, the expectation is that England will win this World Cup now.
Yeah, I mean, I think, and again, I think this taps into that, you know, that England have placed huge store on being accepting the fact that you're the number one side in the world in this format. And let's have absolutely no illusions. England are massive favourites to win this game on Sunday. If they don't win this game, it'll be one of the biggest shocks in major tournament finals. Not because New Zealand aren't a very good side, because they are a very good side. But England, given their resources, given the population that plays cricket in this country compared to New Zealand, given the money in the ECB compared to the New Zealand Cricket Board, we are massive and we're at home. You know, let's be honest, England are big favourites to win this game. So it is an element of dealing with that pressure. I think the toss, okay, England chased today, but potentially the toss could be crucial on Sunday. If New Zealand bat first and Williamson gets big runs and they get a competitive score, then I think we've got a real game on our hands.
And from an Australian point of view, they will not have been expecting this result. They won't have been expecting an 8-wicket margin. Where did they get it wrong?
I think they didn't quite get enough runs, and I think that's the thing, because you saw that when Morgan was in and Cummins was bowling short of him, it was a little bit of a moment there of discomfort for Morgan. But it wasn't discomfort in the sense that the result was in doubt. It was just personal getting through that difficult period of short pitch bowling. And Stark had basically been seen off by that point. And I think, you know, really a higher score would have put England under more pressure when Cummins and Stark were coming into bowl and bowling short and bowling quick. and they didn't quite have the runs to play with, and they hadn't got the early wickets to play with in England's innings to put England under pressure in that middle order against those two genuinely quick and genuinely really good world-class pace bowlers.
And then the Australian question is how they respond to this result, this exit. What's the approach going to be?
Well, I mean, I should have checked this before I came, but I assume they're not going home before the Ashes. The Ashes players, I assume they'll stay in this country. They've got a couple of warm-up games before the Ashes series. Look, I don't think there's any shortage of motivation for Australia in the Ashes. Because
there's even more motivation now,
but I think more to the point, they haven't won the Ashes in this country since 2001. You know, Steve Waugh was the captain when Australia last won the Ashes in this country. Now, in a cricketing sense, that's eons ago. You know, that's a long, long time ago. So much has happened in world cricket since then. So that is their number one motivation, to come and beat England in this country, which they have struggled to do in the last few series. So, but yeah, this adds to it. Definitely this adds to it.
And from an English point of view, is there now a bit of complacency going into the Ashes where you go, well, the last time we played you, we battered you?
I don't think it works like that, because I think it's a different format. That's red ball cricket. This is white ball cricket. It's a different ball. Okay, the pitches might not be, they'll be a bit different. It's a different form of cricket. It's more, I think more, in, it won't be complacency as such. I think the question will be, how do England's test players, if England do go on and win the World Cup, how do they cope with coming back into red ball cricket? How do they deal with the euphoria of winning the World Cup if they do go on to win it? And that's going to be the major challenge, is that Australia will not struggle for motivation. It's England. Can they switch on to the challenge of Test cricket? It won't be complacency as such. I just think it's switching on to a different type of cricket.
And a different squad as well in terms of the personnel.
Yep.
Do you think there was a bit more needle to this particular match because of the allegations of cheating against various members of the Australian squad? Is there still a little bit of nibble, a bit of edge to it from an English perspective?
If I'm completely honest, I didn't really see that today. I think Australia under Aaron Finch and in Tim Payne in the Test captain, they're far more, they've been very conciliatory. I think the Australians have actually conducted themselves very well in this World Cup. They've gone out, they've played a good brand of cricket, they've played hard, but they've played fair. I haven't seen any nastiness from them at all. And they've been playing winning cricket, and they just came up today against a better side, to be honest with you. They'll know that. They're a work in progress when it comes to white ball cricket, except for those exceptional pace bowlers and a couple of really top-class batsmen. They were carrying a few players today. Mm. You know, Marcus Stoinis looked, I'm afraid, a walking wicket. He's not been at top form in this tournament. Peter Handscomb, I mean, come on, that technique in this country. If he plays in the Ashes, England will fancy that. I'm not saying he won't make runs at one point or another, but with that technique, I don't know how he's going to turn it around if he does get picked for the Ashes. I can't see that happening, to be honest. They'll pick different batsmen than him.
Well, it was quite a performance for England. A man of the match, Chris Wokes, who took 3 for 20 today, struggled to put England's achievements into words.
Pretty speechless, actually. An incredible performance from the whole team. Obviously, starting well with the bowling performance and the way the guys are knocked that off is pretty outstanding.
This is Love Sport.
You're listening to The Inside Edge with the cricketer here on Love Sport Radio. And of course, it's a day for revelling in the brilliance of England. But there has also been disappointment, not just for Australia, but for India as well this week. I'm delighted to say we're joined on the line by Chandresh Narayanan, who's an expert in all things Indian cricket. Good evening, Chandresh. Thanks for joining us. Are you disappointed in your side's performance?
Good evening and hello to all the listeners. No, I'm not really disappointed. I think that if India would have gone through to the final, it would have just papered over the cracks that exist in the side, in the sense that the side is still not complete a one-day side. It will take at least 2 more years for it to become a very complete one-day international side. So in a way, it's a blessing in disguise, because this defeat shows them that there are areas that need to be plugged, and they would use this opportunity to plug those gaps.
Where are those cracks then, Chandresh? Because for lots of us, we read down that list, which is a glitzy roll call of world-class names, and we go, well, what have you got to complain about?
I think the problem's in the middle order. And also, I think that because the middle order is a problem, they have not been able to settle on a very very good bowling combination. The bowling attack is very good. It's a wicket-taking bowling attack, and it's a world-class attack. But because they are not sure about their batting, they are forced to make changes to the bowling as a result of the gaps in the middle order. And because of all this, there's been confusion and there's been a muddle in the middle, like I like to call it. So I would say that they need to fix the middle order, and more importantly, they need to take a call on whether they need Mahendra Singh Dhoni anymore in one-day cricket. Indians are very emotional about cricket, and they tend to believe that Mahendra Singh Dhoni should play till he's on his crutches. But cricket doesn't work that way, and they need to take a very hard call very soon on Mahendra Singh Dhoni. I think once they understand where Mahendra Singh Dhoni stands with his 50-over cricket future, then they are able to go around and fix the personnel issues in the middle order, and that will fix the team as a whole. Right now, what's happening is that because there's a big personality in Rohit Sharma and Virat Kohli batting at the top and scoring runs, they are papering over the cracks that are existing currently in the team. And if they fail, like they failed yesterday, then everything comes out in the open.
Hi, Chandresh. James Coyne here from The Cricketer magazine. How are you doing?
I'm very well, James.
Good stuff. What did you think at the time when, one thing I would ask is when India selected their squad in the first place and Rishabh Pant wasn't in, for instance, that was a surprising decision, certainly over here. I was surprised by that. Do you think Pant should have been selected at the start, and should he have even kept wicket, do you think?
I think going forward, Pant will keep wickets in one-day cricket. But yes, he should have been selected in the squad. But I think that Virat Kohli has a problem with the way he approaches his batting. You saw the moment Pant got out, the way Virat stepped out of the dressing room and came out and had a very strong word with Ravi Shastri, the head coach of the Indian team. Mm-hmm. It almost suggested that, you know, it was almost like, you see, that's the reason I don't select this guy in the team, because he's not very careful with his shot selection. And at that time, if Pant had played a bit more sensibly, he could have made a name for himself and become a hero in India. Mm. So I think that the problem with Pant has been that his short selection has not sat down well with someone like a Virat, and he feels that he needs to get a bit more tight with his batting. And I think that going forward, I think Pant will be a regular feature, but I think that he should have been in the one-day squad. And someone like a Dinesh Karthik and Kedar Jadhav did not deserve a place in the 15. In hindsight, it's very easy to say, but they both didn't deserve a place in the 15. So they wasted 4 years in preparing for this World Cup, first by extending Dhoni's tenure as one-day captain by 2 years. And then in the last 2 years, they have tried about 15 people in the middle order and not settled on any one player. Contrast that with what England did. 4 years, they were very focused in what they wanted from their team, and today they are in the final. So I guess somewhere investment in a plan and a strategy helps in a World Cup in the long run.
Chandresh, it's been suggested this week that India had the better players, New Zealand had the better team. How can India reconcile all those stars and get them to play like a unified outfit?
I think that that's being a bit disrespectful to New Zealand. I think that New Zealand also had a very good side. And if you see very closely, India had about 4 players who were really spearheading the campaign for India. It was Jasprit Bumrah with the ball, Virat Kohli and Rohit Sharma, and to some extent KL Rahul. These are the 4 players. You contrast that with New Zealand, it's the same thing. They also had some players who were doing well. Trent Bolt, Lockie Ferguson, Jimmy Neesham and Colin de Grandhomme contributed in some matches. Ross Taylor showed his experience. And Kane Williamson. So they had similar sort of players. So I think it's a bit disrespectful to New Zealand to say that they didn't have the better players. I think it's a misnomer because of the type of aura that surrounds Indian cricket, and especially their captain Virat Kohli. Everybody tend to believe that India has the stars. India basically had 4 players who had really spearheaded in the campaign. You look at an England, almost everybody is contributing. You look at a New Zealand, there is far, far wider contribution. Even other sides, like suppose Australia as well, there are contributions from a lot of players. You don't win tournaments with just 4 players firing. You need bigger contributions from a lot more players, and that's where India failed.
Hi, Chandrish, one other thing about a non-selection in a way. I mean, I personally was flabbergasted that Jadeja wasn't in the side, and I'm not saying this with the benefit of hindsight. I thought that before. Given that he's, you know, an excellent batsman, a very, very good bowler on these pitches, he would have been fantastic. These pitches that were stopping a bit. He's one of the best fielders in the world. He doesn't seem to have played much under Virat Kohli's captaincy, whereas he did play a lot under Dhoni. Do you know what's happened? Is there any insight you can have on what's happening there? Why he's not playing?
I think all this can be traced back to what happened 2 years ago in the Champions Trophy. At that time, it was felt that someone like an Ashwin and Jadeja did not pick wickets in the middle overs, and that was assessed to be the problem why India failed to win Champions Trophy 2 years ago. They felt that finger spinners were not really effective in picking wickets in the middle overs. So out went Jadeja, out went Ashwin, and in came Kuldeep Yadav and Yuzvendra Chahal. So they felt for 2 years, they kept telling the world that it's about playing the wrist spinners in one-day cricket, playing the wrist spinners and getting them to bowl in the middle overs and picking up wickets. And so they started off the tournament with the same strategy. Now, a smarter team would have understood that you have telegraphed your intentions 2 years in advance to the whole world that I'm going to play with these two wrist spinners who are going to be our wicket takers. You saw how England approached them and they destroyed them completely. The same English team last year destroyed them in the one day series that England won last year against India. They should have been a bit smarter and a bit more flexible in their approach. And by the time 2 years and by the time Jadeja played, it was in the last stages of the tournament. So for 2 years, they kept telling us that, you know, it's about wrist spinners and picking wickets. And towards the end, they realized that we actually need a bit more batting depth. So we need someone like a Jadeja to come in and control the middle overs, even if he's giving away 30 runs and not picking up any wicket. So the strategy changed midway through the tournament rather than being flexible throughout.
Chandrish, wonderful stuff. Thank you so much. Lovely to speak to you. Chandrish Narayanan there, who is an Indian cricket expert, joining us on the line. James, just staying with India for a moment, MS Dhoni got quite a lot of stick for basically not getting on with it while chasing a score. What did you make of that criticism?
Well, I, as I say, I think that's just the way he does it. The analogy I make is that it's like a Western storyline. You know, you've got the young guns who come in. They're quick on the draw, but they haven't necessarily got the judgment to make the right calls. So Dhoni rides in on his horse, and you know, he's the cool sort of Clint Eastwood character, and he rides in, and he comes in just the nick of time, just when we think it's over, he comes in and blasts all the bad guys away, and wins everybody's hearts again. And Dhoni almost seems to believe that he's going to do it in every single game the same way.
Do you think there's an arrogance there?
It's not, whether it's arrogance, I don't know. It's just the way, possibly a tiny bit, but then you need to have that. I think it's more the fact that that's the way he assesses the pitch. He gives himself time. He doesn't knacker himself out at the start. He doesn't like taking quick swings. That's the one thing I would say the weakness yesterday. He hit two boundaries yesterday. Now, if he'd hit two more boundaries before he got out, India would probably have won that game. So it's cricket is a risk reward, especially one day cricket is a risk reward balance. And he several times before has saved himself up for the last. He saved all his energy for the last to go and hit those sixes. And yesterday he probably left it ever so slightly too late. We're probably talking an over here. He probably left it four or five balls too late, because then Jadeja was under major pressure and had to hit out to get those runs. We're talking literally three or four balls difference. He left it that late because they couldn't afford to get out those two. It had to be those two that made the runs, really. You know, Bhuvneshwar Kumar, Yuzvendra Chahal, they ain't going to get those runs. So I think we're talking three or four balls difference here.
Yeah, it's extraordinary the extent to which the margins are fine. And they've been fine for England as well, because we're sitting here talking about our side as World Cup finalists. It could have been very, very different. Of course, came into this tournament tipped as the favourites. A real wobble in the earlier stages. How much more satisfying is it as an England fan to have done it in a more dramatic style?
I'll be honest with you, I'm not a fan of the format. I think the format is designed, let's be completely honest, the format is designed for TV. It's designed mainly for Indian TV. We're playing all these games at daytime to suit an Indian TV audience. And we have to go through this massive 9-game group stage. And okay, you can argue there's a clarity to everybody playing everybody. But You have to sit through this massive group stage to get to the knockout games. And if England hadn't hiccuped in the middle, it would have been terrible, the latter stage of this tournament. In a way, we're grateful for the fact, and we're thankful for the fact that England did wobble in the middle, because it added that jeopardy that wouldn't have been there otherwise. And I was really... I'll be honest with you, that was the shock of the tournament, them losing to Sri Lanka in the middle. I did not see that coming. England losing that game to Sri Lanka was unbelievable, really, given that they were chasing that score. So in a way, it makes it more satisfying, but it's sort of a bizarre blip in a way, that game. Not losing to Australia, because Australia in the middle were, you know, they're a very, very good side. Losing that game was no disgrace. But losing that game to Sri Lanka was fairly phenomenal. And I suppose it's just concentrated minds, and it meant they got their blip out of the way, I suppose. And you can have that in a nine-game group stage. And that, to be honest with you, is what the ICC were probably banking on, because they wanted these big teams in at the end to maximise eyeballs on the screen. And lo and behold, who have they got in the semi-finals? They got the three teams that everybody thought would be in there, and New Zealand, who are the best run board outside those big three. So it's no accident, really, that those four have got there, really, in all honesty.
Would there have been an element, as well as an England fan, of you could have done without the stress? It could have been a lot more just beat everyone, let's do it easily and not put us all through the mill.
Oh, but that wouldn't be England in major tournaments, would it?
I mean, in any sport,
let alone cricket. I mean, it's, you know, we haven't won a World Cup since we haven't won a World Cup. We've won the World T20. We haven't won the World Cup. We haven't got to a final since 1992. So we're talking a generation of failure, really, in 50 over cricket. A generation where we've been sort of 3 or 4 years behind everybody else once we get to a major tournament, and we're playing catch up constantly. Finally, we got to a point where we've pressed the fast forward button, and we're at the forefront of the game. So. I didn't foresee them losing to Sri Lanka. I could foresee them losing one or two games, but that game was the real shock to me.
Is this the time then for England to finally win a World Cup?
This is the best chance we've had since 92, and arguably a better chance since 92. It's got to be, hasn't it? I mean, if they don't win this, I've got a slight, my view on this is that if Kane Williamson or Trent Bolt does something extraordinary on Sunday and England play really well other than that, I won't chastise them too much. If they have a really good game. If they play really badly and lose, that's different. But the only circumstances in which there can be spared criticism, really, is if those two players or someone else does something absolutely extraordinary that means that England don't win the World Cup, and if they've still had a good game. I think the big thing is the fact that it's going to be on free-to-air TV. You know, I had a spring in my step when that announcement came through, and I was just leaving the offices at the Cricketer magazine, because that will open up this game potentially to a huge audience. It won't solve everything and all the ingrained problems that we've got in English cricket of no one really following the game anymore to the degree that they used to, but it does at least mean that the armchair fan, the casual fan, the grandfather, the grandmother, the mother, the father, whose kid might not otherwise be interested in cricket, if England do something special in that game, they might go down to their local cricket club and get their kid involved. So that, to me, is the big, great news story from today.
It's massively important that we can all watch it. And coming up, just how important is that?
This is Love Sport.
Whoever you are and whatever you do or don't subscribe to, you're going to be able to watch the World Cup final. It's going to be on Channel 4, not just on Sky. James, that's absolutely massive. I mean, you are a man who lives and breathes cricket. You work for a cricketing magazine, The Cricketer, no less. You'd be able to watch it either way. And even so, you were saying to me just a moment ago that for you, this is massive personally as well.
Absolutely. You know, I very much grew up in the period when it was on either BBC or Channel 4. And, I came from a family which wasn't hugely steeped in cricket. But the fact that it was just on when you came home from school, you meant you got the bug and that was it. And I'm hoping there'll be kids out there on Sunday. And if we're completely honest, it doesn't help that the Wimbledon men's final's on at the same time. The British Grand Prix's on and the Tour de France is on and whatever else is on. But it's still massive that someone can just be at home on Sunday who maybe hasn't seen cricket before, who doesn't even know what cricket is. There'll be people in London today and throughout the UK who don't know what cricket is at all. And if they can watch that game and Jofra Archer does something extraordinary or Adil Rashid does something extraordinary or Owen Morgan, it could be something that they get for life. This being cricket, of course, there's a catch in that just like in the Channel 4 days when they had Test cricket and they used to go off to the races at Haydock or whatever, and you had to switch over to Film 4, and if you didn't have Film 4, you couldn't watch it. They'll be switching onto More 4 for the British Grand Prix, and you can completely understand from Channel 4's perspective that they, you know, they have signed this contract to show the British Grand Prix. It's the only race they're showing all season live. You can completely understand why they've honoured that contract, and that the British Grand Prix will be on in the middle. That's fair enough, but it does mean that potentially some eyeballs will not be watching at that point.
Do you think the fact that cricket isn't as accessible as it was, it isn't on terrestrial TV when you get home from school in the way it was when we were growing up, do you think that that means the sport is losing followers?
Oh, no doubt about it. Absolutely no doubt. It's more complicated than that, because obviously, you know, people, a lot of young people now are following things only on their devices or, you know, on Netflix or whatever. So it's not as simple as saying that free-to-air TV is the silver bullet. And we know that Sky have done a brilliant job. Their coverage is superb. No one disputes that. And Channel 4 and the BBC didn't really bid for the coverage when they lost it to start with, because it was, they didn't have the money, or it was just too unwieldy in their schedule. You know, showing cricket all day, Test cricket all day, is virtually, it's just impossible to do now for these major broadcasters. T20 is different, and that's why with 100 next year coming back on to BBC, and a couple of England T20 international T20 games, men's and women's, that's far easier for them to show on the BBC. But there's no doubt that cricket has lost followers. It's become a smaller game as a result. You know, you look at the participation figures, they've gone down. The ECB won't actually release the current participation figures because they're worried, I think partly because they're worried about what they're going to show. So, you know, the number of people that are joining their local club and playing on a Saturday afternoon, Sunday afternoon, the number of leagues that have, number of clubs that are folding altogether, the number of, you know, midweek leagues that are folding that no longer exist, works teams, yeah, no doubt. But it's not just the terrestrial TV, it's other things. It's society has changed. Society in general has changed.
In what sense? How has society shifted to make cricket less popular?
Look, cricket takes ages to organise. You have to cut the pitch, you have to get the tees ready, you have to sign loads of documentation, it's a far harder...
You've got to learn the LBW rule.
And that's another thing, getting people to stand as umpire all day when they're going to get shouted at by people. So there's all sorts of things that... It's a toxic brew that has meant that cricket is not as popular as it was. There was a day, and it was probably a long time before I was born, where cricket was almost as popular as football. We're talking, people would play football in the winter or rugby in the winter, and they play cricket in the summer, and that was just axiomatic. That was what they did. Those days are gone. And
will they ever come back?
No, I don't think so, because there's so many other things going on. You know, so many other sports now. Those were the big three sports. Football's now raced on. Rugby around the world is becoming popular in all sorts of different countries. Cricket is still... hasn't had that breakthrough those other two sports have had. So no, those days will never come back, but we need to get cricket more popular than it is now. We can't accept the current position of cricket.
And are you surprised to see Sky release their grip on the final?
In a word, yes. You know, you can argue from their perspective, they've shelled out all these millions of pounds to show cricket in this country. I am slightly surprised. It's slightly different, I think, for ICC tournaments, because they sign a separate... I believe, and I'm happy to be corrected on this, that they sign a separate agreement with Star Sports and the ICC to show ICC events. This is not like a bilateral series in England. I believe it's slightly different. I think things have changed in recent years. You know, we've had all these stories that... What I've been talking about, really, about participation. The goalposts have moved slightly. We're almost moved to a point where there's demand coming from the ECB for Sky to be a bit more accessible. A little bit, by the way, this is not denigrating their coverage, which is superb, and I accept they should be standing up for themselves, and I'm not delusional about this, but I am slightly surprised that they've done it. I'm delighted they've done it, because it could be a game changer, and the whole point is people could subscribe to Sky as a result of this, because they've still got the rights going forward.
And if we're being cynical, it is the ultimate PR exercise, isn't it? You spin yourself. In fact, it's not spin. You are the good guy. You're letting everyone watch it, and it'll probably have positive responses. But just a moment ago, you mentioned umpires getting shouted at, which is something we don't see all the time, but we're hearing that Jason Roy has been fined 30% of his match fee and received 2 demerit points for dissent following his dismissal. Do you think that's fair?
Does that, by the way, just do we know if that means he's out of the final?
I don't think so.
No, I mean, look, when I saw that, I I'm not surprised that he's got that sanction from the ICC, because that was obvious dissent, to be honest with you. Look, everyone's frustrated. If he was given out glove behind and he didn't glove it, and it was obvious on the replay that he hadn't gloved it, and the umpire gave him out, and the Australians went up. Once he'd realised that Bairstow had used up the review, and he didn't seem initially, we'd have to ask him, but he didn't seem initially convinced that they still had the review. But once he realised they didn't have the review, he had to just walk off, to be honest with you. Once you've been given. Okay, you can show some light dissent, but he just stood there. You know, it was almost like Chris Broad in Pakistan when he was given out caught behind and stood there for about 2 minutes before Graham Gooch took him off. You know, and the other thing is, Bairstow was given out and reviewed when he shouldn't have reviewed, and Roy was at the other end at the time. So, okay, it's up to the batsman to make that decision to review, but he did have a part in that, in not, you know, he could have said to Bairstow, look, mate, that's plum. Owen Morgan's team has been all about personal responsibility, express yourself. So maybe Bairstow has the leeway to do that in this team. That's fair enough. But once you've been given out and you have no review, you've got to get off, I'm afraid.
But I take your point, but there's an understandable frustration there, isn't there, as a batsman? If you know you're not out, you see the finger go up and you think, well, what on earth is going on here?
I know, but in cricket we have there's still a sort of code of conduct there, and if the umpire gives you out, you're supposed to walk off. Okay, you can show some light unhappiness with the decision. You know, pros have done that for years and years, but there's a difference between doing that and standing there once it's obvious you still haven't got a review. And yeah, I mean, if he was expecting the Aussies to bring him back to recall him, that wasn't going to happen. And actually, this is interesting because Jason Roy would probably play in the Ashes. And he's a terrific player. He could potentially be a game changer for England. It'd be interesting to see if the Aussies start targeting him now.
There's quite an easy sledge there, isn't there? Straight away.
I mean, potentially, yes. But then, every batsman is frustrated when they get given out. There should be enough cricket that flows under the bridge between now and then that it doesn't. People will forget about that. But
yeah.
It could potentially be something that they might use against him.
But I suppose as well, if an Australian goes, "Oi, Jason, you didn't walk," he'll just go, "And what was the score in that particular match?
Well,
and who went through to the World Cup final?"
And also, Aussies generally don't walk. So, you know, my view on this is that it works both ways, because there'll be times when you've nicked it and you're not given. It's changed now in international cricket. That's the thing. And he may have a legitimate point in that there's only one review available. That's a legitimate point, I think, in that maybe there should be more. But and the thing is, in this tournament, it's not as if it's been 400 plays 400 and there's literally no shouts going up because it's so flat and everyone's smashing the ball over the ropes. As I said, this has been more like Test cricket. There's more decisions that have been close, and therefore you can make the argument that there should be more than one review available.
But I suppose the flip side of that is what we're seeing in football a lot at the moment is complaints that VAR is slowing the game down. If we see every time someone's given out we have an appeal, what happens then?
Well, I agree. I mean, look, and there is a point that the game becomes too slow, and you know that's why the ICC have these rules there for the number of reviews that you have, and you can't just constantly slow the game down. And also it becomes a tactic as well. It becomes a tactic that teams use a lot. If you have too many reviews.
I quite like that, though. I like being able to cynically go, no, hang on, you're getting some momentum up, so watch this four times on replay.
You've worked in sport too long, I'm sorry.
It's the cynic in me. To bring it back to a cheerier note, it was a fantastic performance.
Oh, it was amazing.
From
yeah.
England.
Yeah.
How good is this England team? Where do they rank amongst the all-time greats?
Are we talking all England teams or Test them, or just one-day teams or what?
We'll go all one-day teams of all nations.
My God. Look, I think the great Australian side that won the 99 World Cup, the 2003 World Cup and the 2007 World Cup has to go down as the best one-day team ever. You know, you could argue West Indies in the late 70s. Look, one-day cricket wasn't as central to the game as it has become since the 90s, really. I think this is the best England one-day side ever. There's no doubt about that. Okay, we got to the final of the 92 World Cup with a very good side and every player had a first-class 100 and all that. But really, that was an era that was more about Test cricket and people played the game in the manner of Test cricket. In terms of one-day cricket, this is the best England side we've ever had, no doubt about it. And, you know, look at what we've got now. You could argue that in the bowling we're slightly exposed on flatter pitches. But I think all in all, you know, I think man for man and the way they play the game and the way they hit the ball, and I think this has got to be the best England one-day side ever.
It's the golden generation. They've got to do it. And in just a moment, we'll be talking to Tamal Mills, Sussex and England fast bowler, to get his take on this final. Can they go all the way?
This is Love Sport.
You're listening to The Inside Edge with The Cricketer magazine here on Love Sport Radio. You're with me, Johnny Burrow, and James Coyne, assistant editor of The Cricketer. And I'm delighted to say we're also joined on the line by Tamal Mills, Sussex and England fast bowler. Good evening, Tamal. Thanks for joining us. We battered them. Were you expecting it to be that easy?
No, I don't think anybody was. It was a really impressive performance, obviously. You know, when Warner hit that the very first ball of the day for four, you could maybe think, oh, God, Australia could be on here. But, you know, since then it was all England, wasn't it? So it was, I'm sure they'll look back on today and be sat in the dressing room and be really chuffed with their day's work.
Hi, Tamal. James here. How are you doing?
Yeah, good. Thank you, mate.
Good stuff. Obviously, you're a white ball, new ball bowler, if I can call it that. How good was that first few overs by Wokes and Archer there?
Yeah, it was brilliant, wasn't it? It was right on the money. As I said, slightly overpitched first ball from Wokes. There wasn't any swing there initially for him. He got some a bit later on and Warner punished it. And then straight away, they kind of hit their straps and just kind of battered the top of the stump's length before they put the Australians under brilliant pressure throughout. You know, they backed each other up really well. There wasn't any kind of loose deliveries. And they chipped away, took wickets. Thought they really exposed Peter Hanscombe, who obviously you could tell hadn't really played much leading into this game and looked a little bit, you know, off it, and they made him look pretty silly at times and got his wicket, and then they chipped away. Steve Smith kind of gave a little bit of resistance through the middle, but the boys really set the tone well up front.
And England, of course, now can look forward to a World Cup final against New Zealand. The significance of Kane Williamson is getting talked about quite a bit. If you were bowling at him, what would your approach be? How would you try and get him out?
Well, he's obviously one of the best batters in the world, isn't he? And his record speaks for itself. He's one of those characters that's very calm, you know, unfluttered. You know, such a Steve Smith. He plays. He's one of those guys that it's really difficult to bowl. Like, he gets your best ball down to third man for one. That's kind of his trademark, isn't it? I know the commentators always speak about it, but packaged together of him just, you know, opening the face and running that ball down to third man for a single, and it is frustrating. So. You've got to, you know, I'm sure the boys will look to attack him early. Maybe, obviously, if they do get off to a good start and get through the new ball, but then if they take a wicket, you know, with the first or second change bowlers, I'm sure it wouldn't surprise me if you see Jofra Archer come back into the attack to try and get Williamson early before he can kind of bed in for the inning. Because, you know, he is the type of guy that isn't going to get out for 30, 40. He's going to go on and try and control the innings and dictate it. So I think you've got to try and attack him early and then just stay patient and not get too frustrated and go searching for things.
And another world-class player, I mean, and as a left-armer yourself, I presume you have particular admiration for him, Trent Bolt. I mean, give us an indication as to how good this guy is. I mean, he's been exceptional this tournament, hasn't he?
Yeah, he's been brilliant. Anytime you can get, you know, a left arm swinging it back in, you know, it's something that personally I'm working on with that brand new ball, getting it to swing back into the right hander. And cause, you know, we've seen throughout this tournament how difficult it's been. You know, Behrendorf, Stark, Mohammed and Bolt, you know, they've really been kind of standout bowlers, haven't they? Because they've been able to swing the ball back in, get wickets bowled in LBW. Bolt's he's a class performer. You know, he's vastly experienced, played in all the, you know, the T20 leagues around the world, and plays all formats from New Zealand as well. So England will be wary of him, but, you know, the way Roy and Bairstow are playing at the top of the order and the way they handled Stark and Behrendorf today, they won't be afraid, that's for sure.
Tamal, it's the biggest question of all. Are England going to do it?
Yeah, I think so. I think you have to, you know, they'll walk into Lords on Sunday as favourites. New Zealand will be the underdogs, which I'm sure they'll enjoy. But yeah, I think England, you know, they will be the favourites going into that game. They've dealt with Australia today in very convincing fashion, almost the perfect performance, you'd say, with the way they went about the business. And you know, health aside, you know, they'll obviously hope Bairstow's groin niggle, it looked like he got when he was batting. I hope that's not too serious, because he's obviously important for England in the field as well as with the bat. But I think England will be kind of counting down the days, really, and want Sunday to arrive as soon as possible.
Wonderful stuff. Well, we can only hope for an England win. Tamal, lovely to speak to you. Thank you for your time. Tamal Mills there, Sussex and England fast bowler. He reckons we're going to do it, but how are New Zealand going to favour that underdog tag? How can England cope with that pressure?
I mean, I think it's something that New Zealand always get. No matter who they're playing, almost, they're always seemingly the underdogs. I think 4 years ago was fascinating because it was the World Cup was in Australia and New Zealand, and they played all their group games in New Zealand, all their knockout games in New Zealand until the final. They beat South Africa in this amazing crescendo, and with Grant Elliott hitting that six at the end. And they went to Australia, the MCG, and they got absolutely ripped to shreds by Australia. And that was when it was really nasty Australia at that point as well.
Opposed to the lovely, cuddly Australia of today.
As opposed to walking bare feet around grounds and so on, which is actually far more Australian in many ways, you know, go and walk about and so on. Look, I think, in to sound like an Australian, I think what they'll draw on is that this is a team that's very comfortable with themselves. They're very true to themselves. They play the game the way they want to play it. And I think they've been, obviously, it's not like 4 years ago when they were going from New Zealand conditions to Australian conditions. This is, they've been here. They've played in these conditions for the last month. I think they'll relish it, to be honest with you, because they know they're not the favourites for this game. I think they'll honestly enjoy it. They'll go out there and play the way they want to play. I think the big question for them is they've been over reliant on Williamson, on Bolt, on Taylor, and they are their three real top class, world class cricketers. Now, can a Guptill, who's had an absolute nightmare of a tournament apart from that run out, can he come out and score 70 or 50 balls? Can Santner come out and take three wickets? Can these other sort of fringe players come out and do something extraordinary that sets England a really difficult task? Because I think that's what they're going to need. They can't keep going back to these big guys to keep producing these top performances because it's asking too much of them.
Well, who in that England lineup will be scaring New Zealand?
Oh, pretty much a lot of them.
Everyone.
Not scaring them, but they'll be wary of all of them, really. Wokes and Archer today with a new ball, that was superb cricket. You know, Wokes is a very underrated cricketer. You know, he does stuff with that new ball. The top order, you know, they're pretty intimidating, aren't they, when they get going on a good surface. I think that's the England ultimately are stronger in most departments than New Zealand are. That's why they're the favourites. But cricket's a funny game. We saw yesterday that New Zealand came out and took those India wickets. You know, who would have had New Zealand favourites to win that game? Nobody. So, you know, the magic of this World Cup is what the ball's done. And if New Zealand come out and do something extraordinary with the ball, then anything could happen.
Well, that's a worrying sentence, James. Yeah. I want you to give me confidence here, not rattle me. Am I getting carried away? Have England still got quite a bit of work to do here?
I think they're in the right sort of mode now. You know, they've played these three games, which are three crunch games, and they've won them all. They should have. They're on the crest of a wave now. New Zealand actually lost their last two group games and didn't play very well at all. They looked pretty shocking. I saw them against Pakistan when the rot set in, and they looked pretty below par. They roused themselves yesterday for William. Something was a bit of a freak game, really. It was a one day game in a bizarre sort of way. And so, can they come out on a flat? If Lords is flat, can they come out and live with England? That's the question. If Kane Williamson comes out and scores 130, it's anyone's game. So that's the question. Can England curtail those top players and stop those slightly lesser players from doing something special?
Well, when England played New Zealand in the group, they got quite lucky in the manner with which they got Williamson out. Are they going to need a bit of good fortune this time around? What's the approach going to be?
I don't think so. I think if England go out there and play the game they play today, they'll win. So, I think that's, you know, the Lord's pitch should be pretty good, I think. Look, the 10:30 toss is the other thing as well. You know, the 10:30 toss, India batted at 11 o'clock yesterday after the India innings after New Zealand innings was finished. India came out and had to bat at 11 o'clock. Now, that ball is doing a bit at that time. So, you know, it does make it interesting. You know, it does make, the ball has done a bit more than we expected. So, who knows? But it's worth emphasising that England are still the favourites because they have more bases covered than New Zealand do.
England are still the favourites, and we can only hope for a win, a World Cup win, no less, on Sunday. Join us next week on the Inside Edge, when hopefully we'll be looking back on England as champions. See you then. Thanks.
Thanks for downloading this podcast from Love Sport Radio. For more, go to lovesportradio.com for all the latest podcasts, news, and views. Or for more, follow us at Love Sport Radio on Twitter.